Welcome to the KSTE Farm Hour. Here's KSTE's Farmer Fred, Fred Hoffman.
Even though the flames of September's fires are subsiding there, wine grape growers in the Napa-Sonoma area are still taking stock of the damage, and they're attempting to line up financial help. And wine grape growers with insurance face another obstacle in getting quick relief. Insurance companies want to see lab tests for smoke taint on wine grapes, but the companies that specialize in wine grape testing are overwhelmed. It could be a month or more before they can catch up. Raisin grapes in the Central Valley are also affected by the smoke from surrounding fires. We talk with one raisin grape farmer who will explain. We have all that, crop reports, a look ahead at the week's weather, and a chat with an organization that helps aspiring organic farmers learn the business in the Salinas Valley. It's all on the KSTE Farm Hour. Let's get started. It's been called the single worst disaster the wine grape growing community has ever faced. Those are the words of John Aguirre. He's the president of the California Association of Wine Grape Growers. And in many cases, it's not just the flames that are the problem, but ash and smoke exposure, with risk increasing by prolonged or repeated exposure to heavy fresh smoke. California wine country continues to count up the cost of wildfire damage. Wildfires across the western United States, home to most of the country's vineyards, have hit farmers and winemakers already reeling from the Trump administration's trade wars, as well as demand disruptions caused by the coronavirus pandemic. The smoke that's harmful to wine grapes has blanketed much of the West. Fires have charred now more than 4 million acres in California so far this year. That's more than twice the previous record for any year. As we know, here in California wine country, some wineries have completely burned down. Others have had their entire crops ruined by smoke and ash coating the delicate grapes yet to be harvested. The ongoing glass fire has destroyed dozens of buildings in the world-renowned Napa Valley, including the mansion-like Chateau Boswell Winery and a farmhouse containing storage, bottling, and fermentation facilities at the Castello di Amoroso Winery, built to resemble a 13th-century Tuscan castle. Dutch Henry Winery and Sherwin Family Winery told Reuters News their wineries had burned to the ground, and local media have reported damage or destruction to many more. The Newton Vineyard Winery also went up in flames. One Reuters photographer visited the site, and he observed rivulets of red wine mixed with ash flowing down its main access road. Other parts of Napa Valley are still recovering from one of California's largest fires on record. Back in August, the damaged crops and blanketed the valley with thick smoke. One winery owner says crop insurance providers are dealing with 600 claims for smoke taint, and it may be a while before those claims are settled. The California Farm Bureau reports wine grape growers who fear their crops may have been damaged by smoke may be covered by insurance. The problem? Insurance companies want lab tests, and the labs are backlog. ETS Laboratory is one of the country's leading wine labs and is headquartered in Napa Valley. The lab is currently dealing with a backlog of smoke impact testing following this year's fires. Last week, a notice on their website warned of a wait until November for new tests to be submitted. Now, even though private labs have been backlogged, state and university labs have offered to help test the grapes. Smoke taint occurs when smoke is absorbed into the plant and concentrates in the fruit, altering a grape's chemistry, ultimately its taste, leaving some wines with ashtray aromas. Smoke exposure can also impact the functioning of the vine, a result in the delay of fruit ripening or altering the sugar content of the fruit. The smoky flavor may appear during the fermentation process or even as late as after bottling. Grapes that have already been picked from the vine before exposure are safe from smoke taint. Harvest timing plays a key role in whether a vintage is exposed and therefore ruined by smoke, and these timings depend on both the local climate and the grape can vary widely. The heavy smoke in wine country vineyards occurred from mid-August through most of September. Grape harvest, though, begins in early August. One grape variety that may not be as adversely affected are Chardonnay grapes. It's California's most popular white grape, and early harvest in certain areas means some grapes may have been picked before the smoke hit, thus saving them from smoke taint. However, that's not true for the most popular red variety of wine grape, the Cabernet Sauvignon. Harvest for Cab doesn't usually begin until mid-September, and most of these mid- to late-season grapes, including other red varieties, may mean that those grapes will be left on the vine, and as one winery owner put it, they're for the birds. And it's not just California. Oregon and Washington also are having problems. Up in Oregon, in the Willamette Valley, Jason Hansen of Hansen Vineyards expects his crews may only harvest 5 tons of grapes, down from the 25 to 30 tons his fields produced last year. But again, the true impact on the $70 billion wine industry will not be known for months, as the wildfire season is not yet over.
Although the western United States has been suffering from dry weather,
as we move into October, there is a little bit of a glimmer of hope on the horizon. There are some early indications that we're going to experience a pattern change. And initially, we expect to see some cooler weather accompanied by light rain showers moving across about the northern half of California.
That was USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Now, those rain showers will not be particularly heavy at first, but at least it will be a start towards tamping down the wildfire threat, and it will certainly benefit firefighters with their containment efforts for the number of fires that are still active across northern and central California.
This news follows a week where a high-pressure system over California caused dangerous winds.
Depending on what part of the state of California you're talking about, in the south, Santa Ana winds, in the north, sometimes referred to as Diablo winds, also parts of the state that refer to sundowner winds. These winds tend to be very warm, dry, funneling, whistling through the canyons and passes.
He says these winds can make a huge fire out of practically anything.
It takes any type of spark, whether it's a cigarette butt or a downed power line, or even a car parked over grass, many sources of ignition. And at that point, those fires oftentimes take off.
One of the big fires currently raging in California is in Napa County.
That fire, the Glass Fire, exploded from almost nothing to more than 30,000 acres within a couple of days. And unfortunately, it destroyed a couple of wineries and has burned through some orchards and some vineyards.
There so far have been three distinct peaks in California wildfire activity.
We had a big flare-up in mid-August, another flare-up in the California wildfire situation in early September.
The third flare-up came at the end of September. In between all of this activity, firefighters have been busy with containment efforts.
The two lightning complexes that were burning north and south of the Bay Area, the SCU lightning complex and the LNU lightning complex, both between 350 and 400,000 acres, are both 98% contained. So they are largely tamped down, just basically looking for hot spots.
He also points to the August complex fire in Northern California.
That complex has burned an all-time record 902,000 acres. That's about twice the size of California's previous largest wildfire on record. So truly a remarkable season.
Forest Service Deputy Chief John Phipps recently testified before a House subcommittee on the scope of the wildfire situation.
It's an understatement to say that this is an unprecedented year.
He added that the pandemic has exacerbated the challenges.
Our nation is enduring a devastating wildfire year, one that has cut destructive swaths through states like California, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and Arizona, and made more difficult by the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Taking a look at the weather for the week ahead for the southern Sacramento and northern San Joaquin Valleys, sunny skies are in the forecast with above normal temperatures. Highs will range from the mid-80s to the low 90s, overnight lows for the most part in the mid-50s. Next chance of rain? According to AccuWeather, mid-November.
The 2018 Farm Bill modified milk pricing rules to facilitate improved risk management for beverage milk processors, cooperatives, and dairy farmers. While the goal of improving risk management was achieved, American Farm Bureau Federation Chief Economist John Newton says the change cost dairy farmers millions of dollars.
It got rid of what was the higher of in the pricing formula and replaced it with a simple average of the Class 3 and 4 milk prices. And because of COVID-19 price volatility, that milk price is a lot lower than what it would have been otherwise, to the effect of around $400 million in lost revenue for dairy farmers.
Newton says the new milk pricing rules went into effect in May 2019.
It was something that was put into the 2018 Farm Bill, really designed to provide new risk management tools for the beverage milk industry. It allowed them to use futures contracts for milk to hedge their beverage milk price risk. But unfortunately, because of COVID-19 price volatility, it revealed some of the unintended consequences on farmer income.
The change to the milk pricing rules did not proceed through a formal rulemaking process. Newton says farmers are likely to consider potential improvements in the federal milk marketing order.
Since this didn't proceed through the normal rulemaking process to amend federal orders, farmers across the country are likely to consider going back to the previous pricing formula or other changes to the federal order program to improve milk prices. We're also working with USDA and lawmakers on Capitol Hill to achieve what's called modified block voting to ensure those dairy farmers have a voice and a vote on federal order rule changes.
Newton's complete analysis is available on the market intel page at fb.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
Here's this week's California crop report. Fires continued to burn throughout the state, resulting in poor air quality in some areas as smoke and haze permeated the air. In Tulare County, harvested fields were being disked and planted for silage or other forage crops. Silage corn is in various stages of maturity. Alfalfa is maturing and harvesting continues. Dry beans are being picked. Cotton bolls continue to develop with fields setting bolls. Pest control treatments were applied as needed. In the Sacramento Valley, fall groundwork continues. It's winding down. The rice harvest continues at a normal pace. It's expected to be completed around the end of the month. Corn and sunflower harvests continue. Alfalfa cutting continues in Fresno County, but drying was slowed due to heavy smoke. Post-harvest pruning and mechanical topping of stone fruit orchards were ongoing. Persimmons, kiwi fruit, and pomegranates continue to develop. Various table and wine grape varieties were harvested. Fires have severely affected the taste of numerous wine grape varieties. Nectarine, peach, plum, apricot, lemon, lime, and Valencia orange harvests are steady. Olive and Asian pear harvests continue. The almond harvest slowed due to slow drying from heavy smoke. Walnut and pistachio harvests are gaining momentum. In Fresno County, carrots were germinating, but they were growing slowly. Fungicides and herbicides were applied to the crop. The red bell pepper harvest continues. Other late peppers continue to develop. Ground preparation was underway for next year's crop. Eggplant, pepper, sweet corn, and tomatoes continue to mature in Tulare County. Processing tomato harvest has slowed. Brassica and lettuce continues to be harvested in Monterey County. Sacramento, Solano, and Yolo counties are reporting fall crops such as pumpkins and squash are being harvested. Irrigated pasture is reported to be in good condition. Foothill rangeland and non-irrigated pasture, though, rated poor. Foothill fires displaced livestock from some locations. Sheep are grazing on retired cropland as well as on harvested grain fields. The supplemental feeding of cattle is ongoing. And it isn't just wine grapes that are adversely affected by the wildfires. Smoke is preventing raisin grapes from drying efficiently. The California Farm Bureau reports that hazy skies caused by wildfire smoke has slowed the progress of the California raisin crop. Farmers say it's been taking up to 2 weeks longer than usual to dry the grapes and turn them into raisins in San Joaquin Valley vineyards. The smoke won't affect the quality of the raisins, but the delay in drying could reduce the size of the crop by leaving raisins more vulnerable to insects or to damage from an early rain. The California Farm Bureau recently spoke with Randy Rocca. He's a Fresno County raisin farmer, and he talked about the effects of that smoke and the hazy skies on his raisin crop.
2020 has definitely been an exciting year. The crop is much shorter this year. We're thinking somewhere around 15 to some areas, 30% off. And a lot of the crop we're seeing is that we got a lot of good quality this year, primarily because with the lighter crop, the vines were being able to sugar up much earlier. With the smoke that's coming over the valley, we've lost our solar radiation. I've had continuous tray out now on the ground for 16 days, and it's still not ready to pick up. For hand pick guys, without that solar radiation, we're getting insect intrusion underneath the bunches, and we're seeing rot happening almost like we've had a rain. So it's been very challenging this year. If we get a year like last year and it goes into October, we should finish all right as long as the smoke stays out.
Growing raisin grapes is a big part of California's grape industry. Raisin grapes are grown on 158,000 acres here in California. Production, 1.5 million tons per year.
More grapes should be available to consumers as the total U.S. grape crop for table grapes, raisins, wine, and juice grapes is 4% higher than last year.
NAS forecast for the 2021 season includes 10% increase in grape production in Washington State and 4% increase in California.
And USDA research economist Jackie Kramer says regarding the Golden State's table type grape production for fruit used for table grapes and juice.
NAS predicts the 2021 crop of table type grapes to be up 14% from the previous season.
U.S. grape exports have slowed of late due to a combination of factors, such as less supplies to begin the marketing year, higher tariffs in some markets, and lower demand.
So the decline in exports and the lower supplies this season put downward pressure on domestic prices.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
One Northern California farm region may be called the salad bowl of the world, but one country is saying no thanks. It's Canada, and they're levying stringent new import standards on Salinas Valley-grown romaine lettuce as well as mixed salad. The standards are set to last until the end of 2020. The reason? Concerns over any potential E. coli outbreak this fall that might originate in California's so-called Salad Bowl of the World region. The Monterey Herald reports the decision announced by the Canadian Food Inspection Agency has rattled local leaders who say the move effectively shuts down romaine exports to Canada from the Salinas Valley. One of those leaders is Congressman Jimmy Panetta of the Carmel Valley. He said the move caught them by surprise because there have been no reports of E. coli contamination traced to Salinas producers this year. Nor, he said, is the decision based on sound science. Panetta said he's been in immediate contact with the White House, the Food and Drug Administration, the Department of Agriculture, as well as trade representatives to ensure any new standards are workable for Salinas area growers. Importers must now either prove that romaine shipments to Canada do not originate from the four-county Salinas Valley, that includes Monterey, San Benito, Santa Clara, and Santa Cruz counties, or provide an accredited lab's official okay that the romaine lettuce has below detectable levels of E. coli. And there's a lot of green with these greens. The value of the four-county valley's combined crop was nearly $695 million in 2019, according to the Monterey County Crop Report. More than 96 million pounds of produce was exported to Canada from Monterey County alone. Canadian ag officials appear to insist the move is a precautionary one worth taking, citing several outbreaks tied to California produce in recent years.
A recent letter from farm and food groups call on the White House task force to take additional steps and devote new resources to help farmers protect their employees from coronavirus. Allison Crittenden, American Farm Bureau Federation Congressional Relations Director, says more than 160 farm groups signed the letter.
In this letter, all of these ag organizations request that the task force provide some assistance as farmers do their best to provide a safe working environment for farm workers. We know that COVID-19 has brought many challenges, so in this letter, we detail a few requests that the White House Coronavirus Task Force can assist farmers with so that they can do their best to protect their workforce.
The letter seeks funding from the Commodity Credit Corporation to assist farmers in protecting workers, along with additional measures.
These requests include amending housing regulations to allow for RVs or FEMA trailers to be used to facilitate social distancing or isolation housing. It also requests that farm workers and the ag supply chain be designated for PPE prioritization, as well as an eventual vaccine. The letter also asks that testing resources be made available to the ag industry and that results be available timely.
Crittenden says additional resources are vital to protect the food supply chain.
Without those vital employees, we can't get the crop in the ground. We certainly can't pick it, and we can't get it to grocery stores. So it's important that we keep farm workers and farmers alike safe and healthy during this time. And it's important we have the resources that we need to do so.
Michael Clements, Washington.
I love the winter weather.
Well, whether you love it or not, winter is coming. Now, back in the days before modern weather forecasting, many people believed that this time of year, September and October, animals could provide clues about what this winter was going to bring.
And it's not unexpected that people would be interested, particularly in the winter conditions, because that's the time where it's really difficult to survive.
Still is for me. But anyway, that's Mary Knapp. She's the state climatologist for Kansas, stationed at Kansas State University. Of course, as little as 100 years ago, there was no weather service, no way to forecast the winter except by looking for clues in nature. And there are plenty of us who still try to do that today.
One of the most common measures that people hear about are looking at the woolly bear caterpillars and checking to see whether or not the coloration will tell you what the winter will be.
Most say that the smaller the brown stripe and the more black that appears on the caterpillar, the more severe the winter is going to be. The question is it true? Mary Knapp says, no. Researchers cannot find any correlation there, except that the stripes may indicate how wet it was as the caterpillar was developing.
Which is more of an indication of past events than a predictor of future conditions.
Aha, but I've been watching some other animals for my forecast.
What an agent, what a squirrel. What's his name?
Shh, secret squirrel.
Yes, the squirrels know what's going to happen.
People quickly check and look and say, well, the squirrels are burying lots of nuts, so it must be going to be a severe winter. Again, that's more an indication of past events. The nut crop was very plentiful, and so you see a lot of evidence of them storing them up, not necessarily an indication of how severe the winter will be.
Okay, but what about
the horses or cows are growing their winter coats much earlier than usual. Again, an indication of current events, not a predictor of future events.
Well, speaking of future events, the National Weather Service will put out its first major winter forecast for the nation in a few days. Agriculture Department meteorologist Brad Rippey's on the line with me now. You say, Brad, they always base their forecasts on scientific methods. Yeah, but do you think the Weather Service might also have some groundhogs and caterpillars, maybe even a
squirreled
away somewhere and might secretly be consulting with those?
Maybe the Weather Service should be looking at nature, but to my knowledge, they are solely basing their winter outlooks on dynamical and statistical models.
So they say. As for me, I'm going out now, maybe pick up a clue from you-know-who.
Secret squirrel.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington. Be very quiet. Don't let them know about this.
Don't forget, the KSTE Farm Hour is available on your schedule. You can listen to it live, of course, at 6:50 on the AM dial here in Northern California, or stream it live via the iHeartRadio app. And, of course, the KSTE Farm Hour is available as a podcast. Download it from your favorite third-party podcast aggregator, and that includes the iHeartRadio app, Apple Music, and Google Play. The USDA has announced $19.1 million in grants to provide training, outreach, and technical assistance to socially disadvantaged and veteran farmers and ranchers. The following California projects were included. The Asian Business Institute and Resource Center in Fresno received a grant of $237,000 to conduct outreach and training to ensure that Southeast Asian farmers are aware of USDA programs. The Napa Valley Farm Worker Foundation received $347,000 for training and education that builds the financial literacy of current socially disadvantaged farmers. And the Pie Ranch in Pescadero, California received $400,000 to provide opportunities to beginning and early stage farmers and ranchers. The USDA will fund approximately $17.6 million in grants issued to 49 organizations that are conducting outreach and assistance for socially disadvantaged and veteran farmers and ranchers in 28 states.
Americans are preparing more meals at home these days, but do they know how to safely cook frozen foods?
It's a common misconception that a lot of frozen products are fully cooked, fully ready to eat. That can be between meat products, even the produce products, but some products just aren't ready to eat and aren't going to be considered safe to just eat straight out of the package.
Meredith Carruthers of USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service says a recent study asked that question to participating consumers. I'm Rod Bain. The answer, and how it connects to understanding and utilizing proper food safety techniques, is within this edition of Agriculture USA.
Frozen foods are really awesome if you're trying to stock up on things or have things on hand to make quickly or easily once you're at home, not having to cook a full dinner from scratch.
especially as more people have been preparing meals at home in recent months and are continuing to do so, according to Meredith Carruthers of the Agriculture Department's Food Safety and Inspection Service. However, with an increase in consumers who are cooking at home and consumers who perhaps have not done so in a while, Carruthers says concerns are raised about preparing frozen foods in a properly safe manner.
Including the product maybe not being fully ready to eat. Some products might still be raw. They might be breaded or have grill marks or certain things like that to assist with the quality of the product once you do make it and the taste and texture and stuff like that. However, they may not processing wise be fully cooked and ready to eat.
Carruthers says with that in mind, FSIS recently conducted a survey to find out from participating consumers if they know how to safely cook frozen foods by following the instructions provided on the product packaging. The response?
About 22% of the participants said that a not-ready-to-eat frozen chicken product that we were having them preparing in the study, they weren't sure if it was fully cooked, partially cooked, or if it was still completely raw.
Concerning, yes, according to Carruthers, especially in the context of proper frozen food prep and cooking to avoid a foodborne illness.
Very important to follow all of those instructions that the company has put on the package for their product to be prepared safely, as well as for your own safety.
Beyond the numbers, Carruthers believes the study reveals the need for improved consumer education on what packaging terms mean. For instance, several frozen food products contain labeling phrases on the package, such as ready to cook, cook and serve, and oven ready, indicators that the contents need to be cooked. Also indicative of the study results, continuing education how to properly, safely prepare frozen foods. Crowther says that means utilizing food safety techniques, known shorthand as
clean, separate, cook, and chill.
Steps, she says, need to be applied more than ever as more people are buying, stocking up on, and consuming frozen food products. So expanding upon the clean, separate, cook, and chill guidelines for consumers.
Clean is going to focus on having clean hands and proper hand washing, as well as starting with clean utensils and serving surfaces. Separate really focuses on preventing cross-contamination, keeping your raw foods separate from your ready-to-eat foods or foods that aren't going to be cooked later.
Now the cook part of the process calls for the regular use of a food thermometer.
It's really important to have one of those in your arsenal at home, and you can get them in most grocery stores or department stores nowadays, and a food thermometer is really going to be key in making sure your products have been fully cooked and fully prepared to a safe internal temperature and that they're not going to get anybody sick.
For reference, cuts of beef, pork, lamb, and veal are ready when a 145 degree Fahrenheit temperature is recorded inside the meat by a meat thermometer. That after a 3-minute rest time. Most ground meats are properly cooked when the internal temperature reaches 160 degrees Fahrenheit. The exception is ground poultry, as it and whole poultry meat are properly cooked with a 165 degree Fahrenheit internal temperature. Now, what about the chill aspect of food safety?
Chill really focuses on making sure your products are refrigerated within a safe amount of time, keeping things at the proper temperature so no foodborne illness bacteria grow further.
Meredith Carruthers adds a variety of USDA resources are available to assist consumers with food safety questions and information on proper cooking of frozen foods or any meals. On the web, one can go to www.foodsafety.gov. USDA's Foodkeeper app is also available to determine food safety regarding perishable foods. And food safety experts are available through USDA's Meat and Poultry Hotline. That number is 1-888-MP-HOTLINE or by chat during business hours. At ask.usda.gov. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That wet weather forecast for Northern California for yesterday was, well, a disappointment. California started a new water year October 1st, with the state hoping to avoid a second straight dry year. Good reservoir storage from a wet 2019 has tempered the impact of a dry 2020 here in Northern California. The California Farm Bureau reports that long-term forecasts point to the development of a La Nina climate pattern in the Pacific Ocean, which has brought dry weather in the past. The water year ended with reservoirs at 93% of average storage.
Operation Lifesaver partners with American Farm Bureau and other groups during Rail Safety Week to remind farm equipment operators to pay extra attention where field and farm access roads cross train tracks. Operation Lifesaver Executive Director Rachel Molle says Rail Safety Week promotes ways to be safe around crossings.
Rail Safety Week is a concentrated effort on the work that we do on a daily basis, which is getting the rail safety message out to keep people and communities safe on and around railroad tracks. This year, we're joined by our partners in Canada as well as Mexico, making Rail Safety Week a true North American effort.
So far in 2020, Operation Lifesaver reports 149 accidents at private railway crossings on farms. Male offers these tips for farmers as they cross private railway crossings.
When you come up on a crossing, especially on farms, slow down as you approach the crossing, stop, look both ways. You want to make sure you stop at least 15 feet from the crossing because trains can overhang the track. You want to look and listen for a train. Look both ways and look again before you cross, and then you want to cross when it's clear. Once you start crossing the tracks, you don't want to hesitate and you don't want to change gears.
If equipment gets stuck on the tracks, Male says to leave the vehicle and call the number on the blue and white crossing locator sign or call 911. She urges farmers to explore more railway safety tips online.
The best way is to go to our website, oli.org. And you can learn more about Operation Lifesaver, connect with a state coordinator, download videos, posters, and safety messages.
Michael Clements, Washington.
I shall never forget field after field of corn, stunted, earless. For what the sun left, the grasshoppers took.
The year 1936, President Franklin Roosevelt talking about his just completed visit to the nation's midsection where drought and dust prevail. He then proposes a larger national soil conservation program. Fast forward 84 years, and that effort at soil and water conservation continues. One of the newer parts of that effort is the USDA's Conservation Innovation Grant Program. Part of the idea for that is simply
to demonstrate conservation and also link up some very practical on-farm experience of a producer with other producers.
Kevin Norton is acting chief of the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, which has just announced round two of its grant programs, $25 million worth, for on-farm innovative demonstration projects.
14 in total, six of which are in the soil health category.
But Norton says these projects don't just involve one farm or one farmer. The grant money goes to universities and nonprofit groups and such.
Those are the kind of folks that are recipients of these grants. They're going out and putting these demonstration things across multiple farms so that they can reflect the different needs within, say, a watershed.
Or even a county. And as President Roosevelt said wisely in 1936,
water and soil conservation methods may differ in one county from those in an adjoining county.
And in another region. Kevin Norton says that's why these new innovation projects are spread out in many regions, from New England to the Carolinas to Texas and Hawaii and more. The projects themselves focused on many different issues and practices.
Soil health demonstration trials, cover crops, the management-related activities that promote soil health. We are also working with projects that are focusing on irrigation water management, conserving and applying the right amount of water to the crops at the right time in the most efficient way possible, looking at precision agriculture, how that technology can reduce the application of nutrients and improve water quality.
Officials hope these projects will show producers the advantages of, for example, applying cover crops and the best way to do that. In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
A new online service attempts to match landowners who want to reduce wildfire fuels with livestock owners whose animals could graze the land. It's called Match.Graze, and the California Farm Bureau reports that the website was developed by University of California Cooperative Extension. The extension service says grazing can provide an affordable alternative for decreasing grasses and other fire fuels, especially on steep, rocky terrain or land in the urban wildland interface. And that website, again, was called Match.Graze.
Forecast for the 2020 peach crop is down 5% from the previous year.
Coming in at almost 1.3 million pounds for 2020, according to USDA research economist Jacqueline Kramer. She notes U.S. Freestone peach harvest totals are forecasted down 10% from last season. And while South Carolina reports a 7% increase in peach production year over year and its largest crop in 9 years,
the California Freestone peach crop for 2020 was forecast at 6% lower than last year.
And Georgia peach production is down 28%, coming off a 2019 crop that was the state's largest crop yield in 20 years.
Exports have been down from June and July, 10% from the same period last year. So the increase in production could likely put downward pressure on producer prices.
Meanwhile, California's Clingstone peach crop is expected to be 2% larger than last year, with a base price also up 2% from 2019. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
There's an old saying in farming that the person who works the farm will someday own the farm. Add that with the fact the average age of the California farmer is in the upper 50s. Where are the young farmers going to come from? There is an incubator farm system going on in the Salinas Valley. It's called ALBA, which is short for Agriculture and Land-Based Training Association. Basically, it works like this. Farm workers who show the initiative, who show the desire, can end up with a small piece of land at a very reasonable price to find out how it is to actually run a farm. But first, they're going to have to go through a lot of education. So what is ALBA all about? Let's talk with Nathan Harkelrode. He's the Education Program Director for ALBA, which again is short for Agriculture and Land-Based Training Association. Nathan, tell us a little bit about the history of ALBA.
Yeah, well, ALBA's a really special place. We have 100 acres right here in the heart of the Salinas Valley, which is known as the Salad Bowl of the country. The land that we're on actually predates ALBA. It goes back to the 70s of helping farm workers improve their lives through entrepreneurship and starting their own farms. Yeah, there were actually some efforts here in the 70s to help farm workers develop cooperatives. And then over time, it kind of morphed into what it is now, which is really a two-part program where we provide an education course every year. And then graduates of that course can go on and launch a farm on the 90 farmable acres that we have in the incubator.
And the price that they're charged for their land, it's quite reasonable, isn't it?
Well, we've done everything we can to help reduce the barriers to entry of farming and reduce the risk, too. So farmers that start in our incubator, so they at least land at a subsidized rate. In their first year of farming, they only pay 25% of the commercial rate farm. And then each year the subsidy goes down, so they pay something closer to the commercial rate. And by their fourth year here, they're actually paying 85% of the commercial rate.
And your job is basically to teach them all about farming. I imagine everybody that goes through your program says, yeah, I work a farm. I know how it goes. But do they really, with all the business aspects involved and the marketing aspects and so much more? And that's part of your job is to take them through all that.
That's right. Really, to run a small farm, you have to be a jack of all trades. So, our job is to kind of expose people to the many different aspects that are involved in running a farm, from, the production and organic production in particular, to marketing the product, packing it, how to write an invoice. We work with them on, looking at the different marketing channels that are available. And then also really thinking about what they're doing as a business, because at the end of the day, if it's not profitable, it's not going to work. And a big part of what we do actually is during the course that people take here when they first start, we actually farm about a half acre so they can see the full cycle of production, everything that's involved in, and then get involved in many aspects of the marketing, the packing of the produce, and really get the full experience so that they have a good sense of what it's going to be like.
And as any farmer would tell you, part of that experience is keeping records, and I bet that's a module of your program.
That's right, yeah. A lot of people come with a dream of just putting some seeds in the ground and taking good care of the plants, but there's also a lot of record keeping. And of course, in the U.S. and in California in particular, we have a lot of regulations. So there's a lot of time spent exposing our participants to all the different regulations that they'll have to comply with. And of course, managing organic certification record keeping and food safety record keeping too.
How are farm workers chosen for this program?
Well, we have a good reputation. Of course, we do a little bit of advertising. We go to events. We partner with a local community college, so we get students directly from the college as well as farm workers. But a lot of it's just word of mouth. Our farmers are actually some of the best promoters of the work that we do, because once they get to a few acres, usually they're employing people, and then their employees find out about the program through them and through just being here. And people just kind of show up all year long and interested in what we do. There's an estimated 75 to 100,000 farm workers in Monterey County, so there's no shortage of people to recruit from.
There was a survey pointed out in a New York Times article about ALBA recently that mentioned that of the 104 alumni that have taken that training course over the past two decades, 49 still had active farm businesses. And what's really more encouraging is that those who didn't choose to open a farm outside Alba reported increases in their income after graduating and returning to jobs in agriculture and related industries.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we feel like our model is being successful. Of course, we're always trying to improve it, but we're pretty happy with the results of our latest evaluation work that we did. And you're right in that, of course, not everyone at the end of the day is going to be a farmer. It's a lot more than just a job. It's a whole lifestyle, and you have to really have the passion and drive to pursue that. But what we've learned over time is that the training that we provide here for people to start their own businesses and to farm is actually valuable in trying to pursue other careers within the ag industry. And, of course, there's a lot of really good-paying jobs locally, and we're right in the center of a $4.5 billion a year industry that needs people. So we're being more intentional about what we do, and that what we provide can also help people get better jobs.
The article stated that about 70% of Alba's students are immigrants, so I imagine this is a bilingual program.
It is, yeah. We strive to do everything that we can in both English and Spanish. So in terms of courses that we offer and workshops, we bring in trained interpreters to interpret the presentation. Sometimes someone's presenting in Spanish, and the interpretation will be into English because we do have some English-only speaking participants too. And then sometimes it works the other way. Then, of course, anytime we produce materials, we try to do it bilingually, so it's accessible.
And now you're in the middle of school season right now, aren't you? It's a 10-month course that goes from November through September.
Yeah, really, the course spans the whole year. So now it goes from November until the middle of October. And it kind of follows the college calendar because the folks in our course can get college credit through Hartnell Community College right up the road from us. So we have a few breaks in between, but it is pretty much a year-long course.
If people want more information about the Agriculture and Land-Based Training Association's program, what's the website for them to find out more information?
Yeah, our website is www.albafarmers.org, and we also have a Facebook page.
Naturally. Albafarmers.org is the website if you want more information about the Agriculture and Land-Based Training Association. Great work done by Nathan Harklewood, the Education Program Director, and all the others that have put together this great agricultural opportunity for those that someday want to be full-time farmers. It's the Agriculture and Land-Based Training Association over in Salinas. Nathan, thanks for a few minutes of your time.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to talk.
Thanks for listening to the KSTE Farm Hour, heard every Sunday from noon until 1 p.m. Pacific Time, and available anytime as a podcast at kste.com.